Well, the first thing I think he would do would be to stand up and tell the truth. I mean, he had a great expression that was just tell the truth and watch them scatter.
So the further away the problem is, the easier it is to postpone action on it. And that's essentially what we're doing.
Be real. Because people in New Hampshire are really cool.
I'd say get in the game. This is a problem facing your generation. You have to have a voice in the decision.
Welcome to Facing the Future, brought to you by the Concord Coalition on WKXL, New Hampshire's talk radio station. Tune in each week as we dive into topics related to fiscal policy, like healthcare, taxes, national security, the national debt, and more. You will hear discussions with experts, elected officials, and industry leaders on how the nation's fiscal and economic challenges impact current and future generations, and we'll explore some of the solutions. I'm your host and New England Regional Director for the Concord Coalition, Chase Hageman. Today I'll be taking time to speak with Concord Coalition Executive Director Bob Bixby and Communications Director Steve Wynn. But before we dive into today's discussion, let's kick off the program with our first segment, Facing the News, where we will take a few minutes to see what is going on in the world of fiscal policy this week. Congress has yet to strike a bipartisan deal on disaster aid funding, a package which has been stalled for months. And the price tag is expected to keep climbing. In the House, the proposed relief has grown from $14.2 billion to $19.1 billion. The bill passed the House with bipartisan support. Additional funding that came through amendments targeted damaged military bases, highways, levees, dams, and more. Still, the House bill is not expected to become law without revision from the Senate or President, either because of issues related to funding for Puerto Rico or a border wall. House and Senate leaders are hoping to resolve differences by next week. House appropriators advanced a fiscal year 2020 state foreign operations spending bill out of subcommittee, but it has little hope of becoming law. The bill totaled $56.4 billion in diplomacy and foreign aid funding, about $13.7 billion more than the Trump administration requested. But the bill rejects the Trump administration's proposed cuts to the State Department and seeks to overturn several policies put in place by the administration. The House hopes to advance three additional appropriations bills this week, but an agreement to raise budget caps and avoid a government shutdown in September still hasn't been reached. With the addition of these three bills, Democrats will have seven of the 12 annual appropriations bills in the pipeline. But they are all advancing without bipartisan support, which is necessary. Without a resolution on spending limits, Congress faces steep cuts for fiscal year 2020 under a 2011 deficit reduction law. Senate appropriators are moving at a slower pace, originally planning to move the process along after an agreement was struck on spending caps, but without an agreement, the Senate plans to begin work this summer on appropriations bills after passing a, quote, deeming resolution, which would assume a top-line number. $1.5 billion will be diverted by the Pentagon out of military accounts to help fund a wall on the U.S.'s southern border. A total of $2.5 billion has now been moved around, and another $3.6 billion could still be diverted under the National Emergency Declaration in February by President Trump. The single biggest source of recently diverted funds is $604 million originally appropriated for training and equipment for Afghan security forces currently battling the Taliban. The Trump administration is considering redefining the official poverty line by changing the way inflation is calculated. The change could reduce the number of low-income people that qualify for federal benefits, but it would also save the government money. The revision, which would be a move toward chained consumer price index or chained CPI, could amount to $203 billion in savings over a decade, according to the Congressional Budget Office. It would result in lower estimates of inflation by taking into account changes in consumer behavior when prices rise, instead of simply measuring price increases for a stable basket of goods. Supporters say it is a more realistic measure of inflation and a way to help reduce deficits, while opponents say it weakens public assistance programs for those that need them. Up next, Bob Bixby will join me to share memories and insights from his 25-plus years with the Concord Coalition. We'll be back after these short messages. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. I'm joined on the show by Concord Coalition Executive Director Bob Bixby. Bob is an incredibly familiar voice on the show. Welcome back, Bob.
Well, good to be with you, Chase.
I thought it would be fun to do sort of a history lesson of the Concord Coalition, your experience with it, maybe your fondest memories with our founders. So I want to go back in time and experience what it was like to be with Concord in the early 90s. And then maybe we'll get to, at the end, talking about a vision for the future and what you see for Concord coming down the road. So to kick things off, how did Concord come to be? What were those early days like?
Well, it was originally a collaboration between Paul Tsongas and Warren Rudman and Pete Peterson. And I think the reason that it came together was it came out of Paul Tsongas' presidential campaign where he had emphasized fiscal responsibility. And about the same time, Warren Rudman had announced his decision to retire from the Senate, not run for re-election. And Pete Peterson, who was a former Commerce Secretary, had seen them on television together coming from the Concord Inn in Concord, Massachusetts.
I'm noticing a theme.
Yes. And he thought that as he watched them, I think it was on Face the Nation, he saw them together, and they were both talking about pretty much the same thing about how people were ignoring fiscal responsibility. And Peterson asked them if they would be interested in coming together to form this new organization, which they named the Concord Coalition. And I had worked for Paul Tsongas on his presidential campaign as a volunteer. I was actually a delegate at the 92 convention. So I heard about this rumored organization that there was some sort of project that was taking shape between Paul Tsongas and Warren Rudman. And I was very, very interested in what they were going to come up with. And I asked Paul Tsongas about it, and he started chuckling. And he said, this project is taking on a momentum of its own, because a lot of people were talking to him. And so I ended up, you know, just being involved in some of the early organizing from the field perspective, because we, you know, the Tsongas and Rudman wanted us to be not a think tank. They wanted the Concord Coalition to be a grassroots public education oriented entity, because Paul Tsongas had seen in his presidential campaign that people outside of Washington were really concerned about the growth of the national debt and trying to balance the budget. So he knew that there was a grassroots constituency for it. So that was kind of the unique value added. As Paul Tsongas frequently said, there were enough think tanks in Washington that did policy issues. What we needed to do was focus on being outside of Washington. So the Concord Coalition has always maintained that focus of being beyond the Beltway and being public education oriented rather than a think tank per se.
Correct me if I'm wrong, Bob. You are the longest tenured staff member for Concord, and you've climbed the ranks from its early beginnings, where you probably were more of a volunteer role, to a field oriented role, and now you're our executive director.
Yes, I was just kind of an outside volunteer early on, because I had worked on the Tsongas campaign, but I wasn't hired. I wasn't one of the early staff people, but I was in touch still with Paul Tsongas and very interested in what they were doing. So I remember he talked about he called it the Rudman Project at that time. And he told me, yeah, I know you're interested in the Rudman Project. I had that kind of, you know, loose association. The funny thing was, at the time I was practicing law. I had my own law practice in Fredericksburg, Virginia.
A recovering attorney, as they say.
Exactly, yes. And when I said I was interested in working with or for this new entity, I don't think Senator Tsongas took me seriously. I think he thought that I was practicing law and wanted to continue to do that. And what he didn't realize was that I really did not want to continue to practice. And I was thinking that the stuff that I was doing as a volunteer relating to the Concord Coalition was a lot more interesting, and I was much more interested in throwing my effort and time into that. So eventually, you know, the Concord Coalition began to hire some consultants as field people. The initial group of us were hired as consultants, not as staff. So I was one of the first field consultants. I did Virginia West Virginia and Tennessee as a region, and sometimes a little bit of North Carolina. And it was really very, very interesting in those early days. Of course, the attempt to balance the budget was really, that was one of the big, big issues of the day in the early 90s. President Clinton proposed a deficit reduction plan, which the Republicans proposed, but they had their own ideas. And it was a tough time trying to stay nonpartisan, because everybody assumed at the beginning, this is kind of interesting, people are always cynical, people kept wondering, what's your angle? What are you guys up to? There must be something here. This is Paul Tsongas' next campaign, right? Or, you know, he's going to have Rudman as his running mate. And Rudman was like, several people are approaching me about running for president, but I'm not sure I'm going to do that. But they're talking to me about it. And I had a lot of people that would just come up to me after meetings and say, okay, now what's this really about? You know, this is a president. You guys are doing a third party. And I'd say, no, that's just, we're not. And I don't know that they really believed me. Some were disappointed. You know, they just assumed that we were doing a third party and they wanted to join it.
Yeah,
and,
it's like writing a book today. You write a book and do a national tour, you're running for president.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, you know, it was a logical assumption. I could see Tsongas had just run for president. And there were people that thought Warren Rudman would make a good presidential candidate, and he would have. But they were never interested in the Concord Coalition being a third party, where we don't endorse candidates, we don't run candidates, we don't accept money from candidates. They were very, very focused on, no, this is public education about fiscal responsibility. That's it. That's what we do on a nonpartisan basis.
This is Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. I'm talking to Concord Coalition Executive Director Bob Bixby, and we're taking a deep dive in the history of Concord and how it came to be, and some insights on what it was like to work with our founders and the purpose that they had in mind for the organization. What was it like working with Senators Rudman and Tsongas? I never had that privilege. Unfortunately, they passed away before I really got involved with the organization. And I've read books about them. I've read articles about them. There were a lot of things I admired about them, but you got a lot of FaceTime with them. So what was it like?
Well, it was great. I loved working with them both, and on a couple occasions working with them together. They had a seriousness of purpose, and yet they did not take themselves too seriously. They really saw the importance of being able to work together across party lines. I always thought they made a good pair, because Paul Tsongas he had a way of looking at you that would make you feel guilty, even if you know, you didn't do anything. You had these eyes that would just look at you, you know. And so he made people feel guilty about the deficit and the debt, what we should be doing. And Warren Rudman had a slightly different approach. He would just scare you to death. It was just like, you know, how dare we be doing this? He took the moral high ground. Anyway, I thought that they made a very good balancing act that way. And they were very good with audiences. And I think they were both very candid in giving responses. That's why people were attracted to them as politicians. Maybe why neither one of them became president, but they were very...
Too honest to be president?
Yeah, they were both very candid about things, and both had a terrific sense of humor. So I loved working with them.
I want to get into some of the initiatives that you've done over the years with Concord. But before we go down that path, what are some of your favorite memories with Senators Rudman and Tsongas in working with them?
One of my favorite memories is just a small vignette, was being in the green room with them before a PBS NewsHour show. And they're sitting there just going back and forth, arguing and agreeing on some things and arguing with one thing. And one thing that I remember is that Warren Rudman stepped outside at one point and Tsongas said, "Oh, are you going to have a cigarette?" And Rudman said, "Yeah." And Paul said, "You really shouldn't do that." And Warren said, "I'm from New Hampshire. Live free or die." And then, you know, Warren stepped out and Tsongas just looked at me with a big grin on his face. So, I mean, they really got along together very well. I did an event with Paul Tsongas, a big event at East Tennessee State University, and we had previewed our Concord Coalition debt clock there. And we just had, you know, it's amazing. The whole town seemed to be interested in this event. We had a couple of preview events at this college, and I did some pre-media, and I remember staying at the hotel in town, the main hotel. The waitress came that morning and said, "Saw you on TV this morning." And I thought, this whole town is really into this event, you know, and we had a great turnout. And that's the sort of thing I really enjoyed working with the founders. I remember doing an event with Warren Rudman, talked to some of the volunteers I had gathered together in Virginia at one point, and they really loved him. I mean, they just thought, well, one of them got his autograph and said, "Oh, this is just terrific," you know. So it was great.
You talked about some of the events and how sometimes you would go to cities and or towns and the whole town would love the event and get involved. What have been some of the, I guess, more grand initiatives or larger initiatives that Concord has engaged in over the years? And maybe talk a little bit about how you felt they might have succeeded or maybe fallen flat. And on top of that, how the organization has evolved over the years as a result of that.
Well, one of the first things we did was a policy proposal called the Zero Deficit Plan. And that was a tension that we had to resolve within the organization of would we come up with our own plan? If we're going to tell people to balance the budget, as our message was in those days, do you have your own plan for doing it? And the decision was made that we should have a suggested plan. And we did. That was in 1993. There was a Concord Coalition Zero Deficit Plan, which was a major event for us and got a lot of attention at the time. We updated again in 95, and we combined that with a debt clock tour. We had a big debt clock on a trailer that we took on two or three national tours. And that was, I think, the combination of the this is a quintessential Concord Coalition, the zero deficit plan being the policy thing for the policy wonks. Mm. But the debt clock was the thing that it really attracted the attention, because we found when you take this big debt clock on a trailer into towns, smaller cities were a great venue for it because you could park it right in the middle of the city and you'd get a whole lot of attention. Mm-hmm. Bigger cities, it just got lost in. So, I mean, there was no point taking it to New York. I mean, who the heck? You know, you got this. There are all sorts of spectacles in New York City without a debt clock. They have their own debt clock. You took it. But if you took it to a medium-sized city or a smaller-sized city, it would get a great deal of attention, you know, and it was a way of bringing the debt issue to politicians' attention and stimulating a discussion about it. So the debt clock was a very important thing. We've done a couple of different initiatives. I think one of the biggest things we did in later years was the Fiscal Wake-Up Tour, which was really a terrific thing we did with David Walker, who was at the time Comptroller General of the United States and wanted to have a vehicle for being outside of Washington and talking about the importance of fiscal responsibility. So David and I had worked together before on some things, so we talked about doing a roadshow. At the same time, there were scholars from Brookings in Washington and the Heritage Foundation, Washington, who were trying to work together to see if they could come up with some common ground on fiscal issues. So I approached them and said, "Would you like to join David and I on this initiative where we would go around the country and say, okay, we come from different perspectives ideologically, but we do agree on the facts. And so here are the facts that we all agree on, and here are some alternative ideas for dealing with them." And it was a very successful formula. People loved it. So we did that fiscal wake-up tour for 5 or 6 years. Somebody actually made a documentary about it called IOUSA.
Which I've seen.
Yeah, you can still see.
I think it's on YouTube now.
Probably. And like all documentaries, we didn't make it. People thought that maybe we made it. I wouldn't have come across as such an oddball character if we had actually made it.
I do remember one of the scenes you were in, it showed your desk, which appeared particularly disheveled.
Oh, my God. It was piled high with stuff. I always have a messy desk, but that was particularly bad. But it came across well. And when you're making a documentary, you have to have characters. And so
you were one of the characters.
I was happy to be a character for IOUSA. But anyway, no, the Fiscal Wake Up Tour was terrific. You know, I've always found that the most effective Concord Coalition things are, whether it's the Debt Clock Tour or the Fiscal Wake Up Tour, it's things that involve the public and people who are interested and concerned. I mean, people who are concerned about the debt issue and want to learn more about it or do something about it. That's always, and that's been the original mission from that Tsongas and Rudman and Peterson had for us years ago.
I think this will have to be one of our last questions, and I want it to be forward-looking a little bit. We talked a lot about Concord's history, and you've mentioned some concepts or principles that really stood out to me. One of them is the reality that Rudman and Tsongas were of different parties, yet managed to somehow get along with each other and find points of agreement. Certainly there were points of disagreement. So that bipartisanship was important for the founding of the organization. You mentioned how with the Fiscal Wake Up Tour, differing perspectives from even the think tank arena found a common set of facts that they could agree upon to base the conversation around. And another thing that stood out was how in the past we've done events or gone around the country, and there used to be a little more fanfare when it came to issues like this. So a lot of that has changed. It's a very siloed, divided political environment at the moment. It's hard to have bipartisanship on real substantive issues. Fiscal policy is something that has sort of fallen by the wayside in the public eye as we've seen other issues sort of rise to the top. And we could make a strong argument that a lot of those issues actually tie back to budget policy. But when you look at these current dynamics, what do you see for the future of the Concord Coalition, the vision you sort of have for how the organization can continue to engage the citizenry on these important topics?
I think that we, like anybody, need to look at the message and how we communicate the message and evolve with that. So things that we did in the early 90s or mid 90s, even with something like the Fiscal Wake Up Tour, which was like basically 2005 to 2010, those tactics are not the best now for communicating with the public. So I think that the message is still the same, which is the importance of fiscal responsibility, the fact that we do have an unsustainable budget situation. And some of the things that we warned about in the 90s are coming to pass. I mean, we talked about how the baby boomers' retirement would influence the budget and deficits would be larger, and that is happening, and how investments would be squeezed, and that is happening. So, you know, some of the warnings are slowly coming to pass, which is a little bit alarming, and the fact that people aren't paying as much attention, as you noticed, it's not as a big a deal. So our challenge is reaching the millennial generation and younger, explaining why this is an important issue for their future, and that no matter what other substantive policy area you're interested in, it does get back to the fiscal resources needed to do it. Whether you're interested in climate change, whether you're interested in immigration policy, or you're interested in education or defense spending, or you want to keep taxes low, whatever substantive area you're interested in, it does have to fit within a fiscally sustainable framework. Otherwise, if all you're doing is just borrowing money to fund your agenda, eventually it is going to collapse. So getting that message across to a different generation and finding new ways to do that, I think primarily through social media, is really important for us. And we're thinking of ways to do that. And I think, you know, we're not going to do another zero deficit plan, but I think we are going to be looking in the coming months and years at a sustainable economic plan that's fiscally responsible. I like to call it the fiscally responsible economic growth agenda. That's quite a mouthful. But, you know, looking at things like, you know, how the workforce has changed, and with all the boomers retiring, how are we going to keep workforce growth growing? So do we need to get into things like legal immigration and workforce training and how the federal government invests for the future, along with the traditional issues of how do you control health care costs, and finally making Social Security sustainable over the long term? So those are, you know, I think same type of issues, but we need to be more creative in the way we're reaching a new and younger audience.
This is Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. I've been talking to Concord Coalition Executive Director Bob Bixby. We took a deep dive into the history of the organization and its founders and discussed a little bit the vision for the future. Thank you so much, Bob, for coming back on the show.
You're welcome.
We'll be back after these short messages. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman, and I'm joined on the show by Concord's Executive Director, Bob Bixby, and Communications Director, Steve Wynn. You just heard from Bob in the earlier segment, and you know him well. He's a regular contributor, but we don't get to hear from Steve very often. As our Communications Director, he handles media requests and works with Concord's policy experts in preparing issue briefs, blogs, op-ed articles, and broadcast commentary. He edits the newsletter that Concord usually publishes each week that Congress is in session and arranges briefings for newspaper editorial boards and other journalists. Steve is also involved with Concord's grassroots programs around the country, working with the organization's field staff and local partners. He's even taught courses on the media, politics, and American society at Baker University's School of Professional and Graduate Studies in the Kansas City area. Steve has been with Concord for nearly 10 years, having joined our ranks in 2009. Before working with us, he had a 30-year career at the Kansas City Star. Welcome to Facing the Future, Bob and Steve.
Thanks, Chase. Glad to be here.
There are a few reasons I wanted to have you on today, Steve. I wanted to talk about your experience with Concord and some insights you might have to share, but I think maybe a more pressing topic to kick off this segment would be a recent Congressional Budget Office analysis of the president's proposed budget for fiscal year 2020. So maybe you can give our listeners a quick summary of what the CBO had to say about the president's budget proposal.
Yeah, well, I think the bottom line on the CBO report is they looked at the president's budget and then tried to project as best they could where that would leave things over a 10-year period. And they reported that they thought the president's budget would increase the national debt from 78% of the economy, which is the current level, to 87.4% in 10 years. And it's best to kind of measure the debt against the GDP, because that takes into account the inflation and so on. So what this does is basically validates the concerns that the Concord Coalition and a number of other independent analysts had about the president's budget when he released it back in March, which was that it was not going to move us in a positive direction in terms of the debt. And in terms of the deficit, the CBO is projecting that the deficit will total $896 billion under current law this year. Under the president's budget, that deficit will rise to $966 billion in 2020 and pass the $1 trillion mark in 2022.
And so, Steve, if there are differences in the projected deficit under the Congressional Budget Office's original analysis and what the president proposes, is there also a similar difference in the increase in the nation's debt comparing CBO and the Trump proposal? And then what are some of the reasons for those differences?
Well, the Trump proposal, the president's own analysis is a lot more optimistic than CBO's is. And the administration had projected this proposal would actually reduce the debt to 71% of GDP over 10 years. And the main reason for that difference has to do with the administration being a lot more optimistic about projected tax revenues than the CBO.
I think that that's a generous way of putting it, a diplomatic way of putting it. I think that that's from my perspective, that was the big takeaway, was the dramatic difference in revenue projections. I mean, fundamentally, the administration projects booming growth and booming revenue for the outlook of the 10-year period. And just, you know, CBO is a little bit more cautious and traditional, I guess you could say, in their analysis of both growth and revenue. So it's a, gee, it's something like a $3.5 trillion difference or between what the administration thinks is going to come in revenue and what CBO is projecting under the same policies.
It might be a helpful reminder just to throw out there that the president's budget proposal is usually dead on arrival. It's more a political priorities document than a realistic budget proposal. But when CBO did its original analysis, which we've been comparing to the president's proposals, was that based off of existing policy and where we're already headed?
The CBO has a, their basic baseline projections are based on current law. And so you can compare what different proposals might do in terms of increasing or decreasing that number that's shown in the baseline projection. The CBO's report on the president's budget indicated that it would reduce the federal debt relative to baseline projections for current law. But the caution there is that that's based on a lot of things that are in the budget that are certainly dead on arrival, as you know about other budgets. A particular problem with that we've pointed out in this latest budget is that it envisions some very steep cuts in domestic spending that many of them aimed at areas where that are not really where the budget's deficit is growing. They're not big factors in the deficit's growth. Meanwhile, the budget proposes some big spending increases for defense and some additional tax cuts.
So, Steve, you've been doing analysis like this or writing about topics like this for Concord for nearly a decade, and you had decades of media experience before working with us. And the sad fact is you're actually retiring soon. So I thought it would be a pretty appropriate time to have you on Facing the Future to share some of your thoughts and insights based on your experience over the years, and then maybe give us some nuggets of wisdom as we, in fact, face the future without you, which will be a very, very tall order from my perspective. So I guess my opening question with sort of that reality setting the stage, how has the conversation around budget policy changed over the years?
I'll tell you a sad story. For most of my career, I wrote pieces talking about that mentioned the year 2008, because 2008 was when the first baby boomers were going to be eligible for Social Security. And at that point, every year just meant many, many more baby boomers were getting to Social Security, and then 3 years later, Medicare age, and leaving the workforce. And I had assumed for many years when I was younger and more naive that certainly the big physical challenges would be dealt with by 28. Because at that point, you had this massive baby boom start to retire, and we're really going to have to get things squared away by then. So here we are, well past 2008. And the challenges remain. The big problems haven't really been addressed. And now we've got just a much larger, older population that's only going to get increase, and that's going to pose increasing problems. And as we say often at Concord, the longer we put those off, and we've put it off a long time already, the harder it's going to be to fix them.
Let me just jump in here, Chase. When I first started working with Steve was when he was at the Kansas City Star, and we came out there to do a couple of forums, but the reason that we stayed in touch is that Steve was one of the folks out in the country at newspaper outlets were a lot more robust in those days in the things that they covered, and there were more newspapers. But Steve enjoyed writing about this federal budget issue, and not everybody does outside of Washington, and he was really interested in bringing to the readers of the Kansas City Star some of the problems that were pending on, some of these things that at that time looked so far in the future that we did a number of public education events with Steve and the Kansas City Star, which was always very supportive and still is. Steve would call and try to get some information for columns he was writing. So I just think it's very important for folks around, you know, newspaper, whether it's newspaper or other forms of media around the country outside of Washington, to convey this message that it's not some problem that's just going on in Washington. I mean, this translates into people's benefits, people's retirement, people's taxes, and that applies wherever you live.
This is Facing the Future. I'm talking to Concord's Executive Director Bob Bixby and Communications Director Steve Wynn. We started out this segment talking about some recent analysis on a CBO report concerning the president's budget proposal for fiscal year 2020, but transitioned to the reality that Steve is retiring soon, and we're talking about how things have changed when it comes to the conversation concerning fiscal responsibility and fiscal policy as a whole. And I want to continue off of what you just had to say there, Bob and Steve, and set aside politics and policy a little bit here and talk about the communications aspect of things. Bob, you mentioned how, you know, newspapers used to be more robust, and Steve, that's where your career began. How has coverage of these issues and discussion, even in the media, changed since you first started writing about it at the Kansas City Star, Steve, and then even over the last decade with the Concord Coalition?
Well, you know, I was going to follow up on what Bob said about newspapers, and I think obviously the rise of digital media is a big story here, but a part of that story is the decline of newspapers and their editorial pages, and I think that's a tremendous loss for trying to convey to people complex issues, and I think it's not heading in a good direction, although there are good people all over the country trying to make you know, newspapers work, and they're doing it online as well as in print, but it's a difficult struggle. A lot of papers are having problems, and they have been, as Bob said, just around the country, editors, reporters, editorial page editors who are interested in this issue and knowledgeable about this issue, but the circulations of their newspapers are just way down, and in many cases their futures are in doubt in terms of, you know, if there's going to be additional budget cutting and things. And so that's a definite change for the worse. I think in the rise of digital media, there's some great things to it, and there's, of course, some drawbacks. They have the kind of information that we can have at our fingertips. I think younger people may take that for granted a little bit. Years ago, if I wanted a CBO report, somebody had in Washington had to mail it one to me.
Yeah, right.
You know, and now you have all this stuff at your fingertips, and you know, all you need is a link to certain material, and we put out our newsletter with, you know, just send it out in email, and it's got all links to all kinds of stuff, and so it's there's, you know, just some great things there that just weren't on the horizon, even, or barely on the horizon when I was earlier in my career.
It makes it easier to get to reach many, many more people, but it's more difficult to, I think, make sense of the flood of data and perspectives that people have thrown at them.
Yeah, there's so much material, and then, of course, there's the whole issue of, you know, fake material, and that's where I think a good editorial page can really help a community, not just on budget issues, but on any issues in terms of looking into stuff in depth and helping fact-checking. And a lot of news operations, besides editorial pages, do fact-checking. But I think those organizations have the credibility to help people with sorting through all the stuff that they may run into on the Internet. You know, a lot of times it's very difficult. I mean, a lot of times I'll run into something on the Internet that I'm not familiar with, a particular publication or something, and, you know, right away you've got to stop and try and figure out how credible a source it is.
Too, you read something and you wonder, now I have to check the source and see if it makes any sense. And there's so many new sources popping up that some, you don't know. I know from our perspective, the difficulty of not having as many newspaper editorial boards to work with is it makes it more difficult to convey nuance. And the social media is very good at promoting instant reactions and quite frankly, emotional reactions or pithy reactions. And it's fun and it's instant and it gets us all caught up. But what we like to do with a newspaper editorial board is to sit down and have a longer conversation where the editors can, you know, kind of challenge some of your assumptions, and you can come back with some arguments and some data. And I still think that sort of give and take exchange is really important. And I do worry about the trend away from that and just the tendency, just the fact of communicating stuff on social media. The downside is, you know, it promotes things like, well, if we want to talk about the budget deficit or the debt or something, it's easy to send out a tweet that says the debt is terrible. Congress should do something now. All right, but what does that do for you? I mean, it doesn't, you got something off your chest, but so what? And, you know, sometimes budget deficits can be helpful, and you don't want to cut them. So sometimes they're not good, and you should be doing what you need to do, even if it's not politically popular, to get them under control. And it's kind of difficult to convey those things in short, pithy tweets.
Bob, I remember a meeting with an editorial board at one of the bigger papers in the country, and at some point, you know, it was when the economy was in trouble, and at some point the editor turned to you and said, well, I never thought I'd hear the Concord Coalition saying deficits were okay. and you know, Bob explained, well, you know, it depends on the economic circumstances. And I just thought that was an example of kind of thing Bob's talking about, where, you know, somebody just assume so, and we're often described as an anti-deficit group, but there's some subtlety there that should ideally be conveyed. It all depends on what the state of the economy is and whether a deficit's a good idea or a bad idea. Now, just to be clear, we think it's a horrible idea right now because the economy is strong, and this is a classic time to be paying down on the debt rather than increasing it.
I have a whole bunch of other questions I'd like to ask you, Steve, but I'm gonna bring it down to basically one compound question, trying to package up everything you both were just talking about. If you were to turn to young people today, or even the average voter or average citizen who digests news information or data, and if you also had in the same room reporters or editorial boards, what advice would you give them in terms of how to go about gathering, collecting, analyzing fiscal policy-oriented data to help us have a better national conversation? And then I'm going to piggyback on there, Steve. What's one of your favorite Concord Coalition memories?
The answer to the first question, of course, is keep an eye on the Concord Coalition website and subscribe to our newsletter.
buy your Ovaltine.
I think that, you know, the challenge really is to get both younger and older people more interested in the issue and more focused on it. And older people should care because their benefits may be in pretty good shape, but they've got children and grandchildren, and so that's why we need to fix things in the long term. And I think my favorite memories in Concord are meeting people all over the country, and especially, I guess, at our budget exercise games, who were interested in this and were glad to be learning about it and very interested in telling other people about it, and working with a great staff of people over the last 10 years at Concord who really are devoted to this issue and focused on building a better future for the country and for our children and grandchildren.
Well, Steve, you're certainly going to be missed. I've always found your expertise and analysis incredibly helpful. This is Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. You've been listening to me, Concord Coalition Executive Director Bob Bixby, and Communications Director Steve Wynn discuss some CBO analysis, as well as some of Steve's perspective that he's had over the last decade or so that he's worked with the Concord Coalition, and an eye toward the future and recommendations he had for listeners, voters, citizens that should continue this fiscal responsibility conversation. Thank you both for joining the show once again.
Okay, thanks, Chase.
Thank you, Chase.
You have been Facing the Future. I'm Chase Hageman. Thanks for listening.